This is the hardest reading that we will have had, and it's in this area that we're reading today that C.S. Lewis made his living and his competence and his reason for being. Everything else we've been discussing there is hobby. As a hobby, he wrote science fiction. As a hobby, he wrote children's stories. But what he did as a calling within his own competence is in this area of literary criticism and then criticism on education in general and on values in general, which comes out of literary criticism. You can't be a literary critic without some kind of a value. The particular volume of American writings for seniors in our high school today says that the only value that's left in our American society is, they use a crude word for it, but it's simply a satisfactory intercourse. And that's what salvation is in American literature. And if that isn't what you've got, you aren't safe. And this is for our high school seniors. And that's where we finally come, which is, of course, that hideous strength down to where all you have left is animality. And the strange thing is, if you're going to leave man a subject simply to what the so-called scientific method can evolve from him, animality seems to be what's left, although there can be good arguments on the other side, and Borowski has them, but you, in his Science and Human Values. But the plain fact of the matter is that the popular mind interprets it in the direction of its appetite, and now anything goes. It's dangerous to have repressions. Freud has taught us this. Well, Freud didn't, see, what he said is if we didn't have repressions, we'd blow up civilization. This is what he did say. But it gets the other side of it, and that's all they see. And in other words, they hear what they want to hear. And the problem is that with the accent on method in education and with the absence of content and with the fact that our concern for teachers, rightly so, they should get enough money so they can live, but it never is that they get enough time so they can think, you have a real problem in our whole school setup. And he has here, he's simply taking the English educational system and writing a critical essay. But it, as a critical essay, it sums up what he was trying to say. It's in the area of humanitas, the humanities, the tradition of Western civilization, what is a civilized man. But it is not a parochial book. It's one of the few books written in this subject that is not parochial. That is, his mind reigns over the whole earth. And he uses as his explicit theme for this the Chinese word Tao, and unites it with Confucius, as well as with the Greeks and so on. It's what Confucius called a Junshi, and a Junshi is a man of gentility, a man of sensitivity, a man who has value. And as Confucius says, if a man does not subscribe to Tao, it's a waste of time to talk to him. All he sees is his own advantage, and that's what he's for. He can't see life as anything more than for his own advantage. He has no gentility. It's what Aristotle meant when he speaks about megalopsyche, the large-minded man, the large-spirited man. But this is what his concern. And this has been the concern of all civilizing agencies everywhere in the world, independent of one another. The only exceptions we know to this, and this is in the races that are now emerging in new nations, and that's Africa. And you take, for instance, this picture I just saw now of the Biafra in Nigeria, where this fellow is looking at this other man. You don't see a man in either one, unfortunately. You see simply two points, and a couple minutes later, he just took out and shot this captain with his revolver. And this was the end of it. Although the Nigerian army did shoot the lieutenant who shot him later as a military edict, so that they themselves say this is wrong. But this kind of an attitude we see in every war where the crudest things come to the fore, and we have it, as we know, amongst many of our petty officers especially, but sometimes amongst the officers themselves, a lack of gentility and an absence in warfare of humanitas. I remember when we were being invaded and everybody was scared to death, and especially the Spanish, Filipinos, and so on, some of these others who were from that particular time and who had a kind of a way of life that allowed them their summer homes in Baguio, where they retired now and were living. And I comforted all of them in our area with it. If you get in trouble with the ordinary soldier, just be sure your telephone is connected so you can call an officer and he'll take care of it, because an officer would be a gentleman. Now this we could say about pagan Japan. And in general it was true. One of our men who came in and took over our prison camp, for example, his first talk to us, after we've been under rather severe discipline of a rather ignoramus of a civilian who was getting his revenge. And after about a year of this, the military actually took over, and the man assigned to us was a colonel, very fine person. In his first talk to us, he said, "I am not a Christian, but my wife is. And at least I am a gentleman." And he, no, this is his first talk. And he says, "So at least you can expect that I will be a gentleman." And he was. I mean, this is a universal concept, in other words, is what he's declaring.
How long was he there then?
He was there until he got cashiered because two of our men escaped in about 7 months before the end. And then they gave us, as an officer, a man who was not, he was only a lieutenant, second lieutenant at that, but he was battle local. He was just plain crazy, and they just wanted to put him someplace. And he was a farmer's boy that worked up to there. And he had, the peculiar thing of him is when his knees and feet were in the soil, he worked beside me for a while, showing me how to plant commodities the way they did in Japan.
So he wasn't a bad guy.
So he could be quite decent at that moment. But when he was apart from that moment, then he'd be crazy. He'd just crazy. When I had my hemorrhage, he just said, "Let him walk to town. That's all problem." And, no, you can get an X-ray there because the doctors wanted to take me in. I didn't give him, of course. Then he had a kidney attack after that, and then he wrote a note for everybody, "God punished me for my bad tongue." That's all. Mom, this is what you wrote on a little paper. But there is, in other words, with all human beings who have any possibility for reflection, there comes to be some common acceptance of value, some common acceptance of judgment. And we make judgments on one another on this basis. And he's arguing here for something that sometimes is called natural law, but he does not get into this, and he doesn't want to get into that argument. So he calls it the Tao, simply that there is accepted value. Wherever there is man, and man exists at all in community, some kind of accepted value is there. Now, I'll just read from about the center of the book and then go back and read the first essay, because that's all we'll have time for. Is the human mind has no more power of inventing a new value than of imagining a new primary color, or indeed of creating a new sun and a new sky for its movement. So this is his argument. The human mind has no more power of inventing a new value than of imagining a new primary color, or indeed of creating a new sun and a new sky for it to move in. Take Huxley, who writes a lot in this area, on an opposite remark. He says it's remained for the 20th century to be the first to create a new sin, speed. But actually, it was always there. Proverbs 19:2 says, "He that hasteth with his feet sinneth." You can run too fast past a sunset or a bird, even if you don't have a car or bike to do it with. Even before the wheel was invented. So even that sin's always been with us. But value, or the corresponding terms, what we use too, I think, freely, sins, because the scripture doesn't speak to them in quite that way, for the scripture, sin is unbelief. But that this is objective, that it's not a subjective projection, is what his argument is here in the abolition of man. And that in the attempt to make it simply relative, and that we can create new values and so on, that we have destroyed ourselves and what sustains us.
He said, who are you reading from?
This is C.S. Lewis, The Abolition of Man.
Oh.
And for instance, he says, this doesn't mean that there's no progress within these values, in their perception, their understanding. We are able to even see some kind of movement within, of course. But he says this is a good illustration for it, I think. He says, some criticism, some removal of contradictions, even some real development is required. The distinction, for instance, between the silver rule of Confucius and the golden rule of Christ is an advance within value, even though, Confucius says, don't do unto somebody else anything you wouldn't want him to do to you. And our Lord makes it a positive thing so that you can sin in the absence of activity and not simply by activity against the brother in this way. But this is within the same realization of a community and a relationship to it. He says, a theorist about language may approach his native tongue, as it were, from the outside, regarding its genius as a thing that has no claim on him, and advocating wholesale alterations of its idiom and spelling in the interest of commercial convenience or scientific accuracy. This is one thing. A great poet who has loved and been well nurtured in his mother tongue may also make great alterations in it, But his changes of the language are made in the spirit of the language itself. He works from within. The language which suffers has also inspired the changes. That is a different thing, as different as the works of Shakespeare are from basic English. It is a difference between alteration from within and alteration from without, between the organic and the surgical. And so he's arguing here now for then an objective value which can be taught. And taught, it can be caught, because it has to be in both senses. I use here for PLU, was here for the retreat for their faculty last week. One of the great impacts in my life in the meaning of humility and of service was my Greek teacher at St. Olaf, who was a profound Greek scholar in the little town college, and who would spend his Sunday mornings arranging the chairs for the Norwegian service over WCAL and being the janitor, you know. And this kind of a spirit, of a real spirit in this old bachelor of just doing what was to his hand to do. And this made a tremendous impact, I'm sure, on all the preachers that were trained at St. Olaf. They were more willing to be their own janitors on occasion and not feel they'd lost dignity by doing it. And they had a Greek teacher who was able to.
What page did you just read?
I just read from 53, I think. 56, the bottom of 56. The human mind has no more power of inventing a new value than of imagining a new primary color. It's bottom of 56 to the top of 57, the last line. Or indeed of creating a new sun and a new sky for the moon. He's arguing here for objective value. I think as all of you are aware, this is a great argument in today's ethics. The so-called situational ethics is a departure from this within the Christian realm, and evolutionary ethics are a departure from it on the scientific realm. And since in our society very few are trained in any sense in the classics, the meaning of being disciplined in the humanities so that one becomes a gentleman is a concept that so far that a fellow who makes it is like a guy who wearing clothes out of another century. I mean, it just isn't. It remains in certain limited circles.
Does this mean that all the values we've had are the same ones we've always had?
Yes. That wherever reflective men reflect on their existence, the same values become that. So he uses the Tao to kind of sum it up and takes the Chinese word as a sum of it here.
Is this related, Carol, to this part of scripture written on the heart?
Yeah. I doubt whether we are sufficiently attentive to the importance of elementary textbooks. That is why I have chosen as a starting point for these lectures a little book on English intended for boys and girls in upper forms of school. Mary's father was collecting these books from his childhood that he loved and which had definitely existed to create value. Oh, what's the name though, Mary? Yeah, McGuffey readers. No, the McGuffey readers. And they did. I mean, they had this whole selectivity from our American literature and background, so that you did have a strong feeling of kinship with Longfellow or Whittier or whoever it was. They were yours, you know, and they were speaking to you. You didn't spend your time mocking them, which is easy enough to do, but appreciating what they had to say, which an eighth grader could do. Very much do, or fifth grade. Well, anyway, the textbooks are what he's taking. I do not think the authors of this book, there were two of them, intended any harm, and I owe them or their publisher a good language for sending me a complimentary copy. At the same time, I shall have nothing good to say of them. Here is a pretty predicament. I do not want to pillory two modest practicing school teachers who were doing the best they knew, but I cannot be silent about what I think the actual tendency of their work. I therefore propose to conceal their names. I shall refer to these gentlemen as Gaius and Titius, and to their book as the Green Book, but I promise you there's such a book and I have it on my shelves. You even get page numbers in this story. In the second chapter, Gaius and Titius quote the well-known story of Coleridge at the waterfall. Now you remember that there were two tourists present. The one called it sublime, the other pretty. And that Coleridge mentally endorsed the first judgment, reject the second was discussed. Gaius and Titius comment as follows. When the man said that is sublime, he appeared to be making a remark about the waterfall. Actually, he was not making a remark about the waterfall, but a remark about his own feelings. What he was saying was, I have feelings associated in my mind with the word sublime, or shortly I have sublime feelings. There are a good many deep questions settled in a pretty summary fashion, but the authors are not yet finished. They add, this confusion is continually present in language as we use it. We appear to be saying something very important about something, and actually, we are only saying something about our own feelings. Those who read the Hideous Strength, remember, he draws out there that there is a relationship between three philosophies that have gone through the mill in our mental generation, this 20th century. Pragmatism, and then creative evolution, and then logical positivism. And this gradual refinement into subjectivity of our language that logical positivism represents. So all you have is finding the defining of our subjective relationship to the terms that we use. But the authors are not yet finished. They add, this confusion is continually present in language as we use it. We appear to be saying something very important about something, and actually only saying something about our own feelings. There is no objective value, is what they said. Before considering the issues really raised by this momentous little paragraph, designed to remember for the upper forms in schools, that's the high school level, we must eliminate one mere confusion into which Gaius and Titius have fallen. Even on their own view, on any conceivable view, the man who says this is sublime cannot mean I have sublime feelings. Even if we're granted that such qualities as sublimity were simply and solely projected into things from our own emotions, yet the emotions which prompt the projection are the correlatives, and therefore almost the opposites of the qualities projected. The feelings which make a man call an object sublime are not sublime feelings, but feelings of adoration. And here it's just as plain analysis of language of which he's so sharp. And at once, and one on any side of the question has to admit this. You say this is sublime because you feel humble, because you feel sublime. If this is sublime, is to be reduced at all to a statement about the speaker's feeling, the proper translation would be, I have humble feelings. If the view held by Gaius and Titius were consistently applied, it would lead to obvious absurdity. To force him to maintain, you are contemptible, means I have contemptible feelings. In fact, your feelings are contemptible, means my feelings are contemptible. But we need not delay over this, which is the very pons asinorum, the point of asininity of our subject. It would be unjust to Gaius and Titius themselves to emphasize what was doubtless a mere inadvertence. The schoolboy who reads this passage in the Green Book will believe two propositions. Firstly, that all sentences containing a predicate of value are statements about the emotional state of the speaker, and secondly, that all such statements are unimportant. It is true that Gaius and Titius have said neither of these things in so many words. They have treated only one particular predicate of that, as sublime, as a word descriptive of the speaker's emotions. The pupils are left, boy, we sure got a cloud of smoke on that. Okay. What we need is a little fire. That is a statement of an objective fact, too. There's one little, yeah, just to put it down parallel with the other one. Mm-hmm. No good friend of mine says, no good fire can come with two logs, there must be three.
You know, it's appropriate that you're taking this right now.
You think that's better?
Yeah, I think it will go up at least.
And maybe, the third one on there?
I don't know, it's so hot, I don't think it's heated. But let's just take this and throw this little piece in between, and that'll create a part that's going to be right here. Is that that piece? Oh, there it's getting it going on.
There's a little heat in there.
What we need is something to create contact. Fine.
All right, I'm to discuss this because it's very, very timely for me because I have an appointment this evening and tomorrow. I don't know what it's called, I think the governor's conference at the Pacific Science Center in Seattle, at which it's sponsored by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And they have gathered 50 superintendents from the Western United States. I think they do this sort of annually. They pick a different 50 to more or less tell them or talk in your field, you know.
Yes, superintendents?
Yes. And I was going to, although I'm addressing the subject, choosing the experimental subject or the animals on the verge of discovery. They wanted a sexy title. I'm the last speaker, but I have to be there tonight. And I was going to tell them that they really can't be superintendents. if they haven't read The Hideous Strength and the Abolition of Man. But any other suggestions you can make, you know, you can. I may never have the chance again.
Right, you can go on their blacklist. Howie Hong, you know, absolutely believes that the Educational Association of America has a blacklist. You know, I don't know. I wondered sometimes myself on it. But anybody who's ever dared to raise his voice in criticism of their method.
But you know, I was down Oregon one of these, they had the Oregon superintendent, and they really wanted to talk about values.
Well, it's decaying in their hands. It's about time they do. Kind of hard to maintain a school discipline without some sense of value. Even the value of privacy, you see, has been disappearing in the
community. I kind of scared him. I think we were talking partly something about nuclear war.
Now, it's like he says, we can skip this next paragraph a little bit, they'll get the idea that all you do is appear to be saying something very important, when in reality we're only saying something about our feelings. No schoolboy will be able to resist the suggestion brought to him upon about that word only. Well, I think some of them could sleep over it, but it does jar. You know, only is one of those adverbs that always jars me, as well as just us. And I'm just a housewife, or I'm only a layman, or something. I always get curious when I hear this. But with pride, with the dignity.
A homemaker. You don't say just.
As he says, the authors themselves don't realize what they're doing to the boy with this kind of emotive tone in their prose. Before considering the philosophical credentials of the position which Gaius and Titius have adopted about value, I should like to show its practical results on their educational procedure. In their fourth chapter, they quote a silly advertisement of a pleasure cruise and proceed to inoculate their pupils against the sort of writing it exhibits. The advertisement tells us that those who buy tickets for this cruise will go across the Western Ocean where Drake of Devon sailed, adventuring after the treasures of the Indies and bringing home themselves also a treasure of golden hours and glowing colors. It is a bad bit of writing, of course, a venal and bathetic exploitation. Bathetic, bathos is the opposite of pathos. Bathetic exploitation of those emotions of awe and pleasure which men feel in visiting places that have striking associations with history or legend. If Gaius and Titius were to stick to their last and teach their readers, as they promised to do, the art of English composition, it was their business to put this advertisement side by side with passages from great writers in which the very same emotion is well expressed, and then show where the difference lies. They might have used Johnson's famous passage from the Western Islands, which concludes, "That man is little to be envied whose patriotism would not gain force upon the plain of Marathon, or whose piety would not grow warmer among the ruins of Iona." They might have taken that place in the prelude where Wordsworth describes how the antiquity of London first descended on his mind with weight and power, power growing under weight. A lesson which laid such literature before the advertisement, beside the advertisement, really discriminate the good from the bad would have been a lesson worth teaching. There would have been some blood and sap in it, the trees of knowledge and of life growing together. It would also have had the merit of being a lesson in literature, a subject of which Gaius and Titius, despite their professed purpose, are uncommonly shy. Their problem with these very teachers who teach English, they've spent so much time with method, they've hardly read anything. My shock in college was when we had exams across the nation, you know, in literature that were right at that time. I took nothing in college from English or literature. I had a running fight with the head of the English department who I felt was a humanist without the Christian conviction at the center of it. But I come out in my class tops and I don't take any literature at all. The rest of them are so busy studying method and where the guy died and so on. And when he was born, I had time to read his books. And I was spending every Saturday night with a pile of books by my bed. There again, the layman was passionate, you know, or against the professionals who have to have their method. But here he's just saying, they don't seem to know their literature, though they're teaching about how to write it. What they actually do is to point out that the luxurious motor vessel won't really sail where Drake did, that the tourists will not have any adventures, that the treasures they bring home will be of a purely metaphorical nature, and the trip to Margate might provide all the pleasure and rest they require. All this is very true. Talents inferior to those of Gaius and Titius would have sufficed this discovery. What they have not noticed or not cared about is that a very similar treatment could be applied to much good literature which treats the same emotion. What, after all, can the history of early British Christianity and pure reason add to the motives of, for piety as they exist in the 18th century? Why should Mr. Wordsworth's inn be more comfortable or the air of London more healthy because London has existed for a long time? If there is indeed any obstacle which will prevent Cuddy from debunking Johnson and Wordsworth and Lamb and Virgil and Thomas Brown and Mr. de la Mare, as the Green Book debunks the advertisement, Gaius and Titius have given their schoolboy readers no faintest help to its discovery. From this passage, the schoolboy will learn about literature precisely nothing. What he will learn quickly enough and perhaps indelibly is the belief that all emotions aroused by local association are in themselves contrary to reason and contemptible. He will have no notion that there are two ways of being immune to such an advertisement, that it falls equally flat on those who are above it and those who are below it, on the man of real sensibility and on the mere trousered ape who has never been able to conceive the Atlantic as anything more than so many tons of cold salt water. There are two men to whom we offer in vain a false leading article on patriotism and honor. One is the coward, the other is the honorable and patriotic man. None of this is brought before the schoolboy's mind. On the contrary, he is encouraged to reject the lure of the Western Ocean on the very dangerous ground that in so doing he'll prove himself a knowing fellow who can't be bubbled out of his cash. Gaius and Titius, while teaching him nothing about letters, have cut out of his soul, long before he is old enough to choose, the possibility of having certain experiences which thinkers of more authority than they have held to be generous, fruitful, and humane. But it is not only Gaius and Titius in another little book whose author I will call Orbilius. I find the same operation under the same general anesthetic is being carried out. Orbilius chooses for debunking a silly bit of writing on horses, for these animals are praised as the willing servants of the early colonists in Australia. And he gives the references in these books, it's about the end of the book. And he falls into the same trap as Gaius and Titius, of Rusk and Sleipner and the weeping horses of Achilles and the war horse in the book of Job, even a Brer Rabbit and a Peter Rabbit, of man's prehistoric piety to our brother the ox, of all that is the semi-anthropomorphic treatment of beasts, of all that the semi-anthropomorphic treatment of beasts has meant in human history and of the literature where it finds noble or piquant expression, he has not a word to say. Even Black Beauty. Even of the problems of animal psychology as they exist for science, he says nothing. He contents himself with explaining that horses are not secundum literam interested in colonial expansion. This piece of information is really all that his pupils get from him. Why the composition before them is bad when others that lie open to the same charge are good, they do not hear. Much less do they learn of the two classes of men who are respectively above and below the danger of such writing. The man who really knows horses and really loves them, not with anthropomorphic illusions, but with ordinate love, and the irredeemable urban blockhead to whom a horse is merely an old-fashioned means of transport. Some pleasure in their own ponies and dogs they will have lost, some incentive to cruelty or neglect they will have received. Some pleasure in their own knowingness will have entered their minds. That is their day's lesson in English, though in English they have learned nothing. Another little portion of the human heritage has been quietly taken from them before they were old enough to understand. I have hitherto been assuming that such teachers as Gaius and Titius do not fully realize what they are doing and do not intend the far-reaching consequences it will actually have. There is, of course, another possibility. What I have called, presuming on their concurrence in a certain traditional system of values, the trousered ape and the urban blockhead may be precisely the kind of man they really wish to produce. The differences between us may go all the way down. They may really hold that the ordinary human feelings about the past or animals or large waterfalls are contrary to reason and contemptible and ought to be eradicated. They may be intending to make a clean sweep of traditional values and start with a new set. That position will be discussed later. If it is the position which Gaius and Titius are holding, I must for the moment content myself with pointing out that it is a philosophical and not a literary position. In filling their book with it, they have been unjust to the parent or headmaster who buys it, and who's got the work of amateur philosophers or expected the work of professional grammarians. A man would be annoyed if his son returned from the dentist with his teeth untouched and his head crammed with the dentist's obiter dicta on bimetallism or the Baconian theory. But I doubt whether Gaius and Titius have really planned, under cover of teaching English, to propagate their philosophy. I think they have slipped into it for the following reasons. In the first place, literary criticism is difficult, and what they actually do is very much easier. To explain why a bad treatment of some basic human emotion is bad literature, if we can exclude all question-begging attacks on the emotion itself, is a very difficult thing to do. Even Dr. Richards, that's I.A. Richards, some of you who first seriously tackled the problem of badness in literature, failed, I think, to do it. To debunk the emotion on the basis of a commonplace rationalism is within almost anyone's capacity. In the second place, I think Gaius and Titus may have honestly misunderstood the pressing educational need of the moment. They see the world around them swayed by emotional propaganda. They have learned from tradition that youth is sentimental. And they conclude that the best thing they can do is to fortify the minds of young people against emotion. My own experience as a teacher tells an opposite tale. And this, I think, is a good little insight into him, as well as why he reacts as he does. For every one pupil who needs to be guarded from a weak excess of sensibility, there are three to be awakened from the slumber of cold vulgarity. The task of the modern educator is not to cut down jungles, but to irrigate deserts. And there's a good line for you for tonight.
What page is that?
24. The task of the modern educator is not to cut down jungles, but to irrigate deserts. The right defense against false sentiments is to inculcate just sentiments. I mean, the enemy is apathy and not maudlin sentimentality. But apathy has to find such extremes for awakening that only Bonnie and Clyde can do it. So that's why the Time magazine man was so shocked about the monotony. What Lewis meant by monotony was a chance to respond to the delicate nuances. And what the Time man meant is, where do you go out for a blast? The right defense against false sentiments is to inculcate just sentiments. By starving the sensibility of our pupils, we only make them easier prey to the propagandist when he comes. And this was exactly what Conrad Haydn said about Germany. The tragic Germany came and realized they'd sold their soul to Hitler, and in selling their soul to Hitler, they were under the demonic power, but rather that than go back to the emptiness they'd had. Emptiness were you're scared to even show. For famished nature will be abandoned, and a hard heart is no infallible protection against the soft head. For famished nature will be abandoned, and a hard heart is no infallible protection. I think it's true. I like the definition of ulcers. I have them, so I talk about this. That ulcers are the revenge of a frustrated imagination. And I think one reason why we have so many frustrated imaginations is just that. You get caught in the rat race, and there's no escape from it, and you chew on your own stomach. But there is a third and a profounder reason for the procedure which Gaius and Titius adopt. They may be perfectly ready to admit that a good education should build some sentiments while destroying others, and they endeavor to do so. But it is impossible that they should succeed. Do what they will, it is the debunking side of their work, and this side alone which will really tell. In order to grasp this necessity clearly, I must digress for a moment to show that what may be called the educational predicament of Gaius and Titius is different from that of all their predecessors. Tell these superintendents they're welcome to bring their kids up here for a weekend and get to know their names during the winter. Small group, we let them come up for free. Won't charge the superintendents and their wives. They can even bring up their faculty. Maybe you have a chance to get acquainted with who they are. Now this is a good quote here in 25. Until quite modern times, all teachers and even all men believed the universe to be such that certain emotional reactions on our part could be either congruous or incongruous to it. Believed, in fact, that objects did not merely receive but could merit our approval or disapproval, our reverence or our contempt. The reason why Coleridge agreed with the tourist who called the cataract sublime and disagreed with the one who called it pretty was, of course, that he believed inanimate nature to be such that certain responses could be more just or ordinate or appropriate to it than others. And he believed correctly that the tourists thought the same. The man who called the cataract sublime was not intending simply to describe his own emotions about it. He was also claiming that the object was one which merited those emotions. As we know, we've all been out with people, the one who keeps his mouth shut till he has something to say that's coordinate is the one that allows you to see it more clearly. But the one who just talks because they feel embarrassed by this feeling of humility that it brings makes you want to knock their teeth out. You know. They can shut up. They haven't anything to say that really is appropriate. And so we all, by this very reaction, show the justness of his his observation. And I don't care who the guy is, he feels that. All I have to do is put him together with a few women that I know, and then wham, he'd be a convinced man here. There is something objective. But for this plane, there'd be nothing to agree or disagree about. To disagree with this is pretty, if those words simply describe a lady's feelings, would be absurd. If she had said, I feel sick over it, he would hardly have replied, no, I feel quite well. When Sheldon, having compared the human sensibility to an Aeolian lyre, goes on to add that it differs from a lyre in having a power of internal adjustment, whereby it can accommodate its chords to the motions of that which strikes them. He is assuming the same belief. And then here's a wonderful quote from Traher. Can you be righteous, asks Traher, unless you be just in rendering to things their due esteem? Now this word just, even without any knowledge of Plato and his dealing with it, may be difficult to see, but that which has its due. You are just to yourself if in the light of what your training is and your gifts you are allowing them to be absorbed in that to which they are appropriately disciplined. If you have taken all this training and then decide you want to run a filling station because it demands too much discipline of you to prepare a lesson plan for your students, or you don't want to be a teacher, you're being unjust to yourself. And your final frustration will be worse than the first, you see. This is the meaning of just. And that there is, when a man is unjust to himself, also reward that he gathers. Can you be righteous, asked Craver, unless you be just in rendering to things their due esteem? All things were made to be yours, and you were made to prize them according to their value. All things were made to be yours, and you were made to prize them according to their value. Wonderful statements that I think they could put into one of those diamond ads if they put things around sometimes. Well, then they wouldn't sell so many diamonds, maybe. But you prize them according to their value. St. Augustine defines virtue as ordo amoris, the ordinate condition of the affections, to which every object is accorded that kind and degree of love which is appropriate to it. Or you know, like the comic strip says about it. Oh, I like my mummy, but I love apple pie. You know, this is the other side of that one. Aristotle says that the aim of education is to make the pupil like and dislike what he ought. You see, Greeks had very deep conviction that this is objective. And that because it's objective, you're going to suffer if you do not conform to this objectivity. The megalopsyche gains from life even if he ends up a pauper. But the wealthy entrepreneur of Athens developing a new land would never have if he didn't take time to allow these reflections to be part of his own soul. I mean, they believed this. They didn't believe it because they ought to, because that's the way the state would continue to exist, but because it was true. And it still is true. All things were made to be yours, and you were made to prize them according to their value. A wonderful statement. Or again here, that every object is accorded that kind and degree of love which is appropriate to you. The aim of education is to make the pupil dislike and dislike what he ought. When the age for reflective thought comes, the pupil who has been thus trained in ordered affections or just sentiments will easily find the first principles in ethics. But to the corrupt man, they will never be visible at all, and he can make no progress in bad times. Plato before him had said the same thing. The little human animal will not at first have the right responses. It must be trained to feel pleasure, liking, disgust, and hatred at those things which really are pleasant, likable, disgusting, and hateful. Remember his discourse in here on his fear of music at this point, as corrupting him from this, you know. This would arouse contrary passions and would not allow for a hearing. In the Republic, the well-nurtured youth is one who would see most clearly whatever was amiss in ill-made works of man or ill-grown works of nature, and with a just estate would blame and hate the ugly even from his earliest years, and would give delighted praise to beauty, receiving it into his soul and being nourished by it, so that he becomes a man of gentle heart. All this because before he is an age of reason. He is of an age to reason. So that when reason at length comes to him, then bred as he has been, he will hold out his hands and welcome and recognize her because of the affinity he bears to her. This is from the Republic, paragraph 402. In early Hinduism, that conduct in men, which can be called good, consists in conformity to, or almost participation in, a vritta, that is, great ritual or pattern of nature and supernature, which is revealed alike in the cosmic order, the moral virtues, and the ceremonial of the temple. And actually, in not in Confucianism, which is an ethic, but in the Chinese culture itself, which it combines Buddhism and Confucianism, the Li does the same thing. The Li, the very style of life. It includes courtesy, it includes ethics, and so on. That this is one in this whole thing. There's a common rhythm that unites life. This is basic to every kind of community that we know. Righteousness, correctness, order, the Ritta is constantly identified with Satya or truth corresponding to reality. As Plato said, that the good was beyond existence, and Wordsworth, that through virtue the stars were strong, so the Indian master says the gods themselves are born of the Ritta and obey it. The Chinese also speak of a great thing, the greatest thing called the Tao. It's spelled T-A-O, but it is pronounced Tao. It is the reality beyond all predicates, the abyss that was before the Creator himself. It is nature. It is the way, the road. It is the way in which the universe goes on, the way in which things everlastingly emerge, stilly and tranquilly, into space and time. It also is the way which every man should tread in imitation of that cosmic and supercosmic progression, conforming all activities to that great exemplar. In ritual, say the analects, it is harmony with nature that is pride. And Lao Tzu is what makes so much of this. He's the great mystic, but this essential rhythm in the nature of things of which man conforms to become one. The ancient Jews likewise praise the law as being true. That is, it's what it is, reality. The conception in all its forms, Platonic or Aristotelian, Stoic, Christian, Oriental alike, I shall henceforth refer to for brevity simply as the Tao. Some of the accounts of it, which I have quoted, will seem to you, to many of you, merely quaint or even magical. But what is common to them all is something we cannot neglect. It is the doctrine of objective value, the belief that certain attitudes are really true and others really false, to the kind of thing the universe is and the kind of things we know. Those who know the Tao can hold that to call children delightful or old men venerable is not simply to record a psychological fact about our own parental or feeling emotions at the moment, but to recognize a quality which demands a certain response from us, whether we make it or not. I love in the Chinese society this little saying that children should be spoiled before 6 and after 60. Before 6 because of all the trouble they're going to meet, and after 60 because they've made it. And you know, they actually do this in their society. A lot of truth in it. This, they say, is the Tao. He says, because, he says, not to recognize this is a defect in myself, just like being colorblind or tone deaf. He says, I myself do not enjoy the society of small children. Because I speak from within the Tao, I recognize it's a defect in myself, just as a man may have to recognize that he's tone deaf or colorblind. And because our approvals and disapprovals are thus recognitions of objective value, or responses to an objective order. Therefore, emotional states can be in harmony with reason, when we feel liking for what ought to be approved, or out of harmony with reason, when we perceive that liking is due but cannot feel. No emotion is in itself a judgment. In that sense, all emotions and sentiments are illogical, as they don't have a logical basis for the emotion itself. But they can be reasonable or unreasonable as they conform to reason or fail to conform. The heart never takes the place of the head, but it can and should obey. Over against this stands the world of the Green Book. In it, the very possibility of a sentiment being reasonable or even unreasonable has been excluded from the outset. It can be reasonable or unreasonable only if it conforms or fails to conform to something else. To say that the cataract is sublime means saying that our emotion of humility is appropriate or ordinate to the reality, and thus to speak of something else beside the emotion. Just to say that a shoe fits is to speak not only of shoes, but of feet. But this reference is to something beyond the emotions which Gaius and Titius exclude from every sentence containing a predicate of value. Such statements for them refer solely to the emotion. Now the emotion thus considered by itself cannot be either in agreement or disagreement with reason. It is irrational, not as a paralogism is irrational, but as a physical event is irrational. It does not rise even to the dignity of error. On this view, the world of facts without one trace of value, and the world of feelings without one trace of truth or false, of justice or injustice, confront one another in no rapport as possible. I don't know if you've gone down into our pool hall, but you will see this exhibited there by a spontaneous reaction of certain members of the community. And somebody has just put up a piece of a board up there, plywood, $50 plywood they call it. And somebody else has got some dabblings up, and for the fun of it, just because it's got some color, we put up something the kids painted here one morning. Well, did they paint? Painting should involve something of reflection. They just stuck colors on, and a bunch of kids stuck it on. It's at least colorful. So we stuck it up down there in the wall. But it's hardly painting for sale any more than paintings painted by the swishing of a horse's tail and so on. But you know, paintings have been painted that way and have been sold now because of this retreat from the rational and this retreat into the subjective. And then a person can claim this is mine. Well, it may be theirs, but they may be belonging in insane asylum with it if it is there. I mean, this is the problem. So then no judgments can be made. And their fear of judgment is such that they refuse to rise to the rational. Because the minute we rise to the rational, then we have to confront the rationality of one another and be in reflective discussion about it. You see the difficulty? And this is the problem of much of modern poetry, art, and music. That no judgment can be made. You see? And it's a retreat from the rational. And at this point, I don't think it's a part of health. It's honest only to this extent when it reflects the chaotic nature of our time. And this every artist must. And to that extent, there's an honesty in it. And when it's combined with real talent, we feel this and it's worth some money. I'm sure it will represent our age and will be sold if the world endures with a good deal more money 100 years from now. So it's a good investment. For there's an honest man actually crying his anguish into this work of art that's him. But it is subjective. And as he says, there's no possibility of discussion. You don't confront each other, no rapprochement is possible. Hence, the educational problem is wholly different according to you stand within or without the Tao. For those within, the task is to train in the pupil those responses which are in themselves appropriate, whether anyone is making them or not, and in making which the very nature of man consists. Take just one of my bete noires here, because I my associates, sharing the same office, are all people making studies in the young adult world. And in the youth world, in this effort to understand, and certainly this effort to understand is important. But every once in a while I just have to say that it's far more important that youth is spending time to understand me than that I'm spending time to understand youth. Because I reflect a discipline of a lifetime in certain values and anguishes and the sweat on which they are at the beginning of the way. And the problem is not for me to understand them, but for them to understand me. You guys got it all twisted up, you see. Well, our times have had it all twisted up. Parents are spending all their time to understand their children, you know, so-called. Or the idea that there's something objective in training over against which a discipline is possible. I've said I've never spanked my children for any destruction of property, but I certainly spank them for any transgressions of the Tao when they transgress on one another. When they take away the privacy and rights of each other, a little training is necessary. See? And this is what we've lost, isn't it? And it isn't that hard to understand it. They're little egocentric people just like myself, but they still haven't spent enough sweat to get out of it. And so they feel sorry for themselves and they don't get their own way just like I do. Well, anyway, this is one of my pet peeves. But this is part of this picture. You see, this is what we've gotten into, this kind of a confusion. And of course, when we get in that confusion, everything goes. Then finally, who should run the university? The student. Well, if there was ever a student who actually wanted an education, you know, really wanted an education, fine, this would work. But as we all know, the reason why education requires discipline is because sloth is the nature of all of us. And we aren't that eager to want to learn the irregular verbs in Greek. No, I mean, it's just, we aren't. Unless there's somebody at the other side with some kind of a whip, like an F, you're not going to do it. And that's why we allow for all this taxes to a certain group of people to do what is essentially a tough chore. Because teaching isn't easy if you actually are above it. If you don't try, of course, let them take over, then what we've got is what we've got. So he says, you just are left up here with a complete chaotic situation. So you must either decide to remove all sentiments as far as possible from the human minds, or else to encourage some sentiments for reasons that have nothing to do with their intrinsic justness or ordinancy. The latter course involves them in a questionable process of creating in others by suggestion or incantation a mirage which their own reason has successfully dissipated. Like in Brave New World, You know, they're subjected every night to this bombardment. I like brown, I like brown, I like brown. Well, the TV does for us today. And that obviously, if you're an ordinary, sensible human being, what life is concerned about is to get a bigger and better something, whatever it happens to be. And then you don't question this. This is, you question it, you're not a good American. Perhaps this will become clear if we take a concrete instance. When a Roman father told his son that it was a sweet and seemly thing to die for his country, he believed what he said. He was communicating to the son an emotion which he himself shared, and which he believed to be in accord with the value which his judgment discerned in noble death. And he's concerned here, as he is elsewhere, that in order to test any value, you have to take the ultimate. And here's what, for what you give your life. For what will you lay down your life? Is there that which can demand this of us? You see? This is what finally tests it for us. He was giving the boy the best he had, giving of his spirit to humanize him as he'd given of his body to beget him. But Gaius and Titius cannot believe that in calling such a death sweet and seemly, they would be saying something important about something. His own method of debunking would crowd against them if they attempted to do so. For death is not something to eat, and therefore cannot be sweet, dulce, in the literal sense. And it is unlikely that the real sensations preceding will be dulce even by analogy. And as for decorum, that is, only a word describing how some people will feel about your death when they happen to think of it, which won't be often, and will certainly do you no good. There are only two courses open to Gaius and Titius. Either they must go the whole way and debunk this sentiment like any other, or must set themselves to work to produce from outside a sentiment which they believe to be of no value to the pupil, and which may cost him his life, because it is useful to us, the survivors, that our young men should feel it. If they embark on this course, the difference between the old and new education will be an important one. For the old initiated, the new merely conditions, you see, brainwashing. And this is the success of the enemy, in unbrainwashing. So that unless this is felt as a religious conviction, remember the brainwashing succeeded, as the Korean investigation showed. The old dealt with its pupils as grown birds deal with young birds when they teach them to fly. The new deals with them more as the poultry keeper deals with young birds, making them thus or thus for purpose of which the birds know nothing. Much better roasting. In a word, the old was a kind of propagation, men transmitting manhood to men. The new is merely propaganda. It is to their credit that Gaius and Titius embrace the first alternative. Propaganda is their abomination, not because their own philosophy gives a ground for condemning it or anything else, but because they are better than their principles. You see, this exists for a little while, always, in everything. Men are better than what they're saying. They probably have some vague notion, I will examine in my next lecture, that valor and good faith and justice should be sufficiently commended to the pupil on what they would call rational or biological or modern grounds if it should ever become necessary. In the meantime, they leave the matter alone and get on with the business of debunking. But this course, though less inhuman, is not less disastrous than the opposite alternative of cynical propaganda. Let's suppose for a moment the harder virtues could really be theoretically justified with no appeal to objective value. It still remains true that no justification of virtue will enable a man to be virtuous. Without the aid of trained emotions, the intellect is powerless against the animal organism. I'd sooner play cards against a man who's quite skeptical about ethics, but bred to believe that a gentleman does not cheat, than against an irreproachable moral philosopher who's been brought up among sharpers. In battle, it is not syllogisms that will keep the reluctant nerves and muscles to their post in the third hour of the bombardment. The crudest sentimentalism, such as Gaius and Titius could wince at, about a flag or country or regiment, would be of more use. We were all told it long ago by Plato. As the king governs by his executive, so reason and man must rule in their appetites by means of the spirited element. The head rules the belly through the chest. That's why this is entitled Men Without Chests. The chest, the seat, as Alanus tells us, of magnanimity, the magnanimous man, again, the megaloseat. Of emotions organized by trained habit into stable sentiments. The chest, magnanimity, sentiment. These are the indispensable liaison officers between cerebral man and visceral man. It may even be said that it is by this middle animal element that man is man. By his intellect he is mere spirit, and by his appetite mere animal. The operation of the Green Book and its kind is to produce what may be called men without chests. It is an outrage that they should be commonly spoken of as intellectuals. This gives them the chance to say that he who attacks them attacks intelligence. It is not so. They are not distinguished from other men by any unusual skill in finding truth, or any virginal ardor to pursue her. Indeed, it would be strange if they were. A persevering devotion of truth, a nice sense of intellectual honor, cannot be long maintained without the aid of a sentiment which Gaius and Titus could debunk as easily as any other. That's what happens in the hideous strength. The scientist even falsifies his evidence. And C.P. Snow has dealt with this even in his novels on the community. You know. It is not excessive thought, but defect of fertile and generous emotion that marks them up. Their heads are no bigger than the ordinary. It is the atrophy of the chest beneath them that makes them seem so. And all the time, such is the tragic comedy of our situation, we continue to clamor for those very qualities which we are rendering impossible. You can hardly open a periodical without coming across a statement that what our civilization needs is more drive or dynamism or self-sacrifice or creativity. In a sort of ghastly simplicity, we remove the organ and demand the function. We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and build the gelding. Be fruitful. And this is his essay on which he has based his novel, That Is His Strength. So the two are saying exactly the
novel
same.
What?
The novel is exactly the same as this. That Hideous Strength. Mm-hmm. This novel is based on
that essay. Mm-hmm.
And he says as much himself. This was
that essay is entitled Abolition of Man.
That essay is entitled Abolition of Man, the novel That Hideous Strength. And he says in here, this is a tall story about devilry, though it has behind it a serious point which I've tried to make in my Abolition of Man. In the story, the outer rim of that devilry has to be shown touching the life of some ordinary and respectable profession. I selected my own profession, not of course because I think fellows of college is more likely to be thus corrupted than anyone else, but because my own is the only profession I know well enough to like.
Here's something on a book jacket that I found about why Lewis wrote his books. I didn't hear mention these, I don't know where it says, this is him. That is, I wrote the books I should have liked to read if I only could have found them. That's always been my reason for writing. People won't write the books I want, so I have to do it for myself. No rot about self-expression.
No, that's what I was saying. He was doing it for his own delight. And I said this. He didn't write to propagandize, but simply for his delight. So they aren't preaching. I mean, when he preaches, he writes an essay, which is where it belongs. But the book he writes out of this conviction, so it represents the world of which he is convinced, but it does it in this delightful way of fantasy and fun. I mean, it was refreshing for him to write, it was refreshing for us to read it. But I know now for myself, in my classes, this is that I've only taught at the postgraduate level. I've never taught there except in continents. I never taught anything with postgraduates. And my argument with them on words to me is has been always a profound dismay. Well, why not? This word works as well as another. And for instance, just say for instance, theologically, a man writes, and this is his senior orals, his final paper for his final exam going into ministry. Christ is the emanation of God. Well, emanation means something quite different from what Jesus Christ is. It is completely heretical. It belongs to a Gnostic theory that he only seems to be what he is, you see, and it is a corrupt word. But to get this guy to see it, you see what I mean? Well, I report this to the faculty, because this fellow's very well, it's too late now, he's been in the ministry, he's finished his work, and he'll be a good pastor. I think he'll be a good, better pastor than I am, says one of the Protestant church history. I said, I have no question to be a better pastor than I am, I said, as far as his temperament goes, but I'd sure hate to be amongst his people on Sunday morning. You see, because words count. And in here, here's where the whole message is thrown out. You know, you're going to get a lot of palaver on Sunday morning about ethics and being nice guys and so on until they're ready to puke over it. And they won't know why they're so bored when they go to church, but they'll sure know they're bored. Because words count. But to get them to see it, you see. And this is why in our particular tradition we're so strong in this whole thing of languages. I'm not good at them. I am philological by discipline and not by competence. but to know the language so that you do reflect and see what words mean is so completely important if people are to be in the communication at all. And then the problem of transferring it into images becomes the pastor's, and that's a bigger task. As I say, the difference between a theological professor and the pastor is the difference between an artist and an art critic. We don't give the honor to the art critic, we give it to the artist. And a good preacher is the artist. But most of them will say, oh, I'm just a pastor. I don't pretend to be a theologian. So I wish they'd pretend a little and try a little when they say that. But I think this is then up to every layman. If you're not getting any kind of proclamation, you've got to preach it to yourself. And we're all called to be theologians. You have to reflect on your experience. It's impossible for you not to, I think. And this is where I believe everybody has to be disciplined on this time. When you look back at your life and see the things you've been busy about, you realize that things would have gone even if you hadn't been so busy. No, I could have read a few more books and been with my family a little more these 5 years, and the village would still be here and doing practically as well, I see. And we know this. We could have worked a few less hours in a day and had a little more time to think than we, you know. And our family wouldn't have starved to death, and our kids would have still gotten to school.
Some of us would qualify your remark a little bit, yeah. Regarding you.
Doesn't run by itself.
No, I know, but lots of things that go better.
Of any concern, whether it's going to be success, so it's the head. It either goes ahead or it goes like this.
But you see, time for reflection should be part of that going ahead, too. You know, we have to be what we proclaim.
Yes, but if you commit yourself to a certain job, a duty, and you're not there to function.
Well, this is another thing.
Who's going to do it?
This is another thing.
This
yes.
is what.
And that's what I say about C.S. Lewis. That's
see.
Right. He had the competence and he did his own job. And these are his hobbies. This is right. But we all know we take ourselves sometimes more seriously than the situation itself requires.
Well.
But it's not always easy to be just to ourselves in the situation.
Or to delegate. Then you have to delegate so that someone will carry on when you're not there.
Yeah.
Don't you think that's important too? So that you can have a little more time for reflecting and being with your family if you have someone that you know is carrying on for you.
Well, sometimes in this business of keeping your nose to the grindstone, you're actually decreasing your ability to do
right.
the job
right.
well.
Yeah.
And
right.
you're actually inhibiting
Amen.
What you're supposed to be doing. It's this whole business of Hamlet, you know, this above all thine own self and truth, all about that might be fault in any man.
Now the Presbyterian Church has faced this in a very manful way, I think. You notice all their calls demand that the pastor take 6 weeks off, of which 2 are to be spent in study and 4 in a vacation. And that's the way all the calls are now made in Presbyterian Church.
Our church is advocating that too now, 2 weeks for study for the pastors. At the last convention, that's what they were.
Because what's going to happen in our society is that those who are supposedly the people of reflection leisure are the ones who have none. Because when the people who don't use their time for leisure get the leisure, they're in so much trouble that they take all your time helping them out of their trouble.
Right.
And this is exactly what we're happening right now. And one of the delightful science fiction short stories of last year was just this, that a fellow had himself put to sleep for 500 years and comes back, and when he comes to and his discovery is going on, this fellow in their car speedometer says 120 miles an hour, and he's looking outside, and that it can't be 30 miles an hour, something's wrong here, and he listens to them talking, and he realizes that the whole mass of people's IQ has gone down to about 60, and the million or so intellectuals are working themselves to death, keeping everything up, but they got to keep fooling everybody just to keep it up, and they are at a place where they can be fooled. Because we have continually fatigued the group of people who do carry these values for civilization, so that they disappear. It's a good little short story, and this is what could happen, unless we can arrive at this kind of a community we have here. If communities learn how to organize their own potentials in the way we do here, they'll have, I think, a real exciting community in the next century.
If you study the life of a successful businessman, he's a man that has been able to surround himself with men that he can delegate authority to and let them do the work.
Yeah.
Instead of him beating on his brains, he has all these people doing things for him. And in every business, you have to have
people, it's be surrounded with people that you can delegate the authority to.
This is right. This is its whole secret.
It's the same here, or in church, or wherever you are. Put the layman to work.
And this is why I clamor so hard for two teachers to every class, even in the Sunday school and at the seminary, but particularly, I think, in your local churches, that people want some weekends, they need some time off, the other teacher's there, and with two teachers, when they're both there, there's never a discipline problem. And not only that, but then the students get a chance to also have one countered by the other, so their life will get a little more gospel, you know, and not just have somebody impose their particular legalism or tradition on them. I think even right up through the whole system it should be so. And I notice how much more we're doing it on the graduate level, for you do have multiple seminars or inter-faculty approaches and so on. Well, thank you. This is the end, then.
Good to see you.
I gotta go over and say goodbye to Leo. He's got all these.
Leo's leaving, huh?
Yeah, he's got the 70 superintendents he talked to today.
Oh, yeah.